Hello and welcome to the Ship Shape Podcast, a series of podcasts where we meet amazing people and talk about their experiences, personal, technical, and all related to the maritime world. Come and dive in, dive in.
Today on the Ship Shape Podcast, we speak with the president, founder, and CEO of Nautical Ventures, Roger Moore. So let's hear his James Bond story on the water. A world sailor, a liveaboard, a mover and shaker in the industry. Your hosts today are Meryl Shrett. I'm a liveaboard on a Ta Shing to Sheba 36 in Boston, Massachusetts, and T.
Hey, everybody. This is Talha Bhatti. I'm aboard my Lures 40 in Virginia. And we have a legend with us today. Yeah, he's been living aboard for years and years. He's got lots of stories. He even had a pet monkey. I'm really excited about that angle. So we're going to jump all over the place. But welcome to the show, Roger.
Well, thanks for having me on the show. I'm excited to share my history and the last 30 years that I've been living aboard and loving it. People ask me what in the world is going on in my mind that I don't want to live in a house. And after living aboard, there's nothing that suits me better. So I love it and I'm happy to share my experiences and how this got started.
Well, as you say that, I'm reflecting on my own scenario and maybe it wasn't that bad of an idea to live on a board for the past 6 years. So Roger, where are you coming to us from?
I'm coming to you from my office here in central Fort Lauderdale, which is our main office for Nautical Ventures. We have about 12 locations now throughout Florida, but this is our, I call it the intergalactic headquarters, which is obviously an exaggeration, but I'm a little bit of that way anyway. So we'll start it off with that.
Yeah, fun headquarters.
Love it. So where did this all start? Like what's the origin story?
Well, we can go way back when I was just in New York as a kid. My parents had a boat. We'd spend every weekend on it. They had it on the Kilvan Call, an old Atlas Yacht Club there. And when Dad got 2 weeks vacation, we'd move it down to the beach and we'd spend the 2 weeks on the boat. So I was brought around boats because my dad loved it. That was a 33-foot wheeler. You know, we'd live aboard it for 2 weeks. And I had my first boat was a little 8-foot pram. And then at 16, I had my eyes on this correct craft, a 17-foot correct craft that needed a lot of work. And my dad said, Raj, if you want to do it, I'll match whatever you match. It was a 600 back then. And man, I came up with $300 in a real hurry, working my tail off at the marina and was surprised. And that was the start. This 16-foot correct craft with a 60-horse Ford flathead V8 in it. And
So this is a fast center console then, yeah?
No, it's not really a center console. It's that old style, you know, forward seating and aft seating.
Okay. Like a wheeler again, sort of.
Yes. A wheeler. They're still making them, the older correct crafts. I loved it. I learned a lot about engines and boat maintenance and fiberglassing. Just love the boat to death. And when we left New York and my folks moved to California, I went out there and got into business after school. I flunked out of school after 2.5 years because I didn't realize at the time that I was ADD and I had a lot of trouble in school. I got A's in chemistry, math, and physics, and F's in anything I didn't like. So I was a problem child and a problem student. Had a knack for business and ended up getting in several businesses in California without going through all that. Purchased a 50-foot Gulfstar to use for business and fun in the Chisco Bay area, which is a phenomenal place to sail, as you guys probably know.
So these first marine businesses, though, what were they? Was it more chartering or repair, or what was it?
What they weren't marine businesses. It was I was in the real estate business.
Oh. So you just had a boat on the side and.
Right.
Okay.
Purification. I have several patents in the field of water purification for drinking water and, you know, had a really nice series of careers and several businesses there. In 1986, we sold our business. We, because my wife and I helped build it, or we built it. We decided or I suggested, let's take off and cruise down the coast of California. Well, she'd been cruising in the bay. You know, we had the 50-foot Gulf Star, and she loved it. So she said, okay, whatever you want, Rod. She was wonderful. We bought this 63-foot Choi Lee motor sailor.
Wow.
Everybody said, Roger, that's not a sailboat. It's not a powerboat. That's the worst of both worlds. And we proved over the next 13 years that it was a perfect boat for
really.
So I was really lucky in selecting.
But that's a big boat, though. That's 60 feet.
Yeah, 63 feet and heavy and catch rig, but it was phenomenal. So if there's any tip to anybody that's thinking about cruising, I have a cute little story that never cruised. We'd never been out of the bay. So I went down to the bookstore and I talked to somebody there and I said, listen, can you get me a couple of books on cruising? And I'd like to know what the bay people want to do. And I'd like to know how the nice way to cruise is. So I got a couple of books. One of them was called James Cornell Cruising Routes, which was more like a dictionary or an encyclopedia of where and when to go. And then I got James Skoog, Cruising in Comfort. That was a great book because he really went into all the creature comforts that we're used to. And if you go out there and try and rough it too much, maybe guys can get by with that, but the women don't like it. So you're not going to have a happy couple.
Good advice.
Yep. So the Choi Lee was fantastic because it had a great galley, freezers, refrigerators, generator, air conditioning, ice maker. We had all the creature comforts. Mm. So my wife loved it. I loved it. And what was supposed to be a six-month journey down the coast of California, what I call gunk-holing, you know, stopping in every bay, every marina, mostly at anchor, we loved it.
Mm.
And after about 4.5 months, we were in San Diego and said, hey, let's go to Mexico.
Nice.
So we started cruising down the coast of Mexico and got as far as Acapulco, which is, if you look at a map, it's a long way down. We didn't know what to do from there. We met some people that were planning to cross the Pacific. And I pointed at them and I said, you're nuts. That's 850 miles. No way am I going to do that. 30 days later, off we went.
And 30? What? In the same boat? I mean, it's an ocean-ready boat, right? It's,
you know, 30 days later, 30 days after we got to Acapulco, we had made the decision to go ahead and make the crossing. And the crossing took us 22 days. It was a magical journey for us. Some of the funny stories is we were a motor sailor and we were going with three other boats. This is a lot of detail, but I think a fun story on how we started.
Sure, sure.
So we're having all these meetings. Samantha, my wife, who sadly passed away 5 years ago, my mate for 48 years. But anyways, we talked about the planning. And she said, Roger, they can launch the space shuttle with less planning than you guys are for this trip. I mean, we really worked at it. One of the captains thought he could pick up the Southeast trade. So he headed south. Another was going north. Of the three boats, one dropped out. So it was us and two other boats. Really cool people. One guy was a doctor. His wife was a nurse. Other people were in the real estate business. And we all went a little different direction based on our gut feel about where the trade winds were blowing. We also departed based on waterline length. So the slower boats with the shorter waterline length left first. And then we left last, being a 63. You know, we had a pretty steady 6-knot cruising speed on one engine. And or sailing, and she sailed pretty well also. So off we go across the Pacific. And I have too many stories. So you guys have to cut.
Well, let me ask you this. So, you know, we've talked to sailors all the time. There's obviously the whole conversation of, you know, more boat, more problem, and having a budget based on certain size of boat. I mean, having a 60-foot boat and cruising for that long, how did you really budget this whole thing? Like, how'd you manage that?
All right. Well, that's a great question. Because when we started, I was having trouble getting insurance because two of us on a 63-foot boat, insurance company didn't feel that that was adequate crew. We thought it was adequate crew, needless to say. And They promised me I had insurance. By the time we arrived at our destination, I found out we didn't have insurance. So at that point, I said, the heck with the insurance, we'll self-insure. And we owned the boat because I'd sold our business and we owned the boat. So we didn't have payments on the boat. And I've actually calculated we were spending about $32,000 a year. That was our cost to do the trip that we did over 13 years. And that also included one of us traveling home each year. We never both left the boat. Somebody was always with the boat from whatever departure point that was. So for $30,000, I had a couple of real estate investments that were generating a little bit more than that. I think that's an attainable number. Maybe that number's 40,000 now, but it's not as expensive as you think. Of course,
that's nice.
We were anchoring. We didn't like going in the marinas. Samantha was a great cook. So, you know, we'd eat on the boat. And as we go through this story, we really became the locals. And when we stopped places, so cost of living was minimal. And another preparatory story, when we started out here, it had two 3208 V8, you know, cat diesels in it. And it was a catch rig with, you know, a nice rig. So I needed to learn more about diesel engines. So I hired the cat mechanic. I brought him to the boat and I said, will you bring any specialty tools with you? An extra set. I'll buy them. And I sat him down on the battery box in the engine room, gave him a beer and said, teach me how to adjust the valves. Teach me how to pull the injection pump. Teach me the basic things that I'm going to need to know if we're not around. And of course, I had all the manuals, so I'm making notes in the manuals. And I did the work. He told me what to do. And wow, did that pay off.
Yep, I bet. And that's a good tip, though, right? Is that you, especially for these longer passages, you definitely need to know your boat inside out.
Absolutely. And we did the same thing with the air conditioning guys. I'd bring a tank of Freon, bring a set of gauges, bring any specialty tools, teach me how to recharge the AC, and we know what the pressures should be. And I bought a book, the Encyclopedia of Air Conditioning. So when I forgot some of the stuff, I could go look at it. And my God, that helped so much for refrigeration and AC. I was helping.
And so at this point, Roger, do you already have the monkey at this point?
No. Don't have the monkey.
No. Okay. So this is the first passage. So you left Mexico, Acapulco, and you went towards?
The Marquesas was our first stop. And that was 22 days. And we could have gone 90 days. I mean, we had a great routine, which was kind of natural for our biorhythms. I'm a morning person. She's an evening person. She would take first watch from maybe 8 o'clock until 2 a.m, like 6 hours. And she'd wake me up. And then I'd take the watch at 2 a.m. or 1 o'clock, depending upon how she felt, which was great for me. Because it was exciting to be on the boat and, you know, it's black and you can see the stars and it's just so gorgeous out there. And I could look forward to and get excited about the sunrise. So by the time the sun came up, Samantha had a nice rest. We'd have breakfast together and we had a routine where we had breakfast, lunch and dinner together. The 6 hours was not difficult for us. People try two and two and wow, you just don't get the rest.
Yeah, that's hectic.
A very interesting little piece of this was as we started, we were a bit nervous to take off and lose the sight of land. And as we took off in Acapulco and we saw the lights disappear in the distance, it was time for a swap, you know, next shift. I went down to the master stateroom to wake up Sam and I stepped on the carpet, this beautiful white carpet we had in the cabin. It's squishy. It's full of water. I said, oh my God, what is this? So I reach down and I touch it and taste it. It's salt water. I said, oh my God, we're not even 6 hours out. And where the hell are we taking the water? I was pretty upset. Thank God Samantha was an adventurer because I was ready to turn around. You know, I'd spent getting the boat ready, everything, spare parts, thinking out everything. And here we are, you know, 10, 12 hours out of Acapulco. And we've got salt water entering the boat. What is going on? So I said, Sam, let's turn around and go back. And she said, Raj, let's consider that we're halfway. What would you do if we were? And I said, you know what? You're something else. Yeah, let's do that. So I climbed in the lazarette and couldn't find the water. I had lots of tools on board. So I pulled the upholstery off the settee in the back, took the saber saw and cut a big hole in it, and found that when they built the boat to drill the holes in the aft bulkhead, they just drilled hole after hole after hole and then punched the middle out. And there are all these little stars sticking out, all these little protrusions.
Whoa.
Well, this 6-inch exhaust pipe pulsates a little bit, you know, as it built up the water, then it spits the water out. So it wore a hole the size of your pinky finger in the bottom of this hose. And that's where the water was coming from. So we shut down that engine, started the other engine. And the reason we're starting engines here is because in the bowl, if you look at Mexico, there's kind of like a big bowl there, and there's not much wind. So you got to motor out of that or sail at 2 knots, which is no fun. So we're motoring out, we're sailing out, and we switched the engines. And then I got some silicone. We had rubber material on the boat, a couple of big hose clamps, and I smeared it with silicone, put the rubber on there and the hose clamps. And to this day, I think it's still the same way. That was really fun to solve the problem.
And continue the trip, right? That's going to be the biggest plus.
Absolutely. Boy, you guys started something here. We can go on for a long time. Of the three boats that ended up making this crossing, the one went down to pick up the Southeast trades, which did not materialize. The name of their boat was Cartella. That was the real estate guy and his wife. They had what I'd call a daisy chain electrical system. They needed the engine running to charge the batteries for the inverter to be able to operate the air conditioning and the refrigeration. And they lost the inverter, so they had no refrigeration. All their frozen goods that were in there for the trip were deteriorating. They weren't picking up the Southeast trades. It was a horrific trip for them. Absolutely horrible. Becalmed, as we'd talk twice a day at noon and midnight on the ham radio. We'd hear them. They were starting to get really irritated with one another. If you've been on a sailboat and there's not a lot of wind and you don't have power, when that boat rolls, you know how the mast slaps and the sails bang. Oh, it's
the doldrums.
Yeah.
Right?
That's where we were in the doldrums. Yeah. The other boat that was ahead of us that took off the smaller boat, that was called Kahuna, the doctor and his wife. We were about halfway across when we were in pretty close proximity to one another. So we altered course and we rendezvoused in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. It was amazing. And the swells in the South Pacific are huge. We'd see his boat disappear and then come up on top of the swells and disappear again. Mm. They came up and we rendezvoused. We hooked a bunch of lines together, let their boat trail off the back of our boat, which was called Good Grief.
Good Grief.
They swam over with a bottle of wine, and we sat on the back deck and had a bottle of wine in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, the two of us. It was really cool. We had a great water maker, and I said, how's your trip going? They said, well, we don't have the AC. It's hot as heck. We got to rinse ourselves off 3 or 4 times a day. We're running low on water. So I said, how many hoses have you got? They had 2. We had 2. We hooked them all up, and I filled their tank up.
So that's a cool way to do it. That's what friends are for, right? Yep,
they were so excited about that. It was fun. So off we go. And the next day at noon, we're doing our standard noon HF communication. How you doing? And Jerry says, Roger, there's a helicopter hovering overhead. I got to get off the line. I'll call you back. I said, a helicopter? Are you hallucinating? There's no helicopter that could be flying 1,500 miles from land. He said, shut up. I'll call you back. So turns out there was a longliner fishing boat out of San Diego, and they have a helicopter spotter plane to spot the schools, and then they send out their launches with the nets to get them. Well, they saw Kahuna and his American flag, so they went over and asked them, did they need anything? And they didn't have the guts to tell me that they needed some diesel as well, because they're a sailboat, right?
Yeah.
So these guys dispatch 30 gallons of diesel to them on one of their tenders and 2 quarts of chocolate ice cream. So Kahuna gets filled with water, 30 gallons of fuel, and some chocolate ice cream in the middle of the
ocean. Love it.
And it was really cool. So anyway, off we go. And that, of course, we're talking to our poor friends south who are bashing and rolling. And when they got to the Marquesas, they headed north to Hawaii and sold the boat.
That does it. But then the flip side was true for you guys, right? Like, you guys were now just in hook, line, and sinker, right? You were addicted for life.
Pretty much, because once you go that distance, what do? You can go to Hawaii and then back. We just decided to keep going, which was never the intention. It was supposed to be a six-month journey, and the 6 months, as you'll see, turned into be 13 years to go 45,000 nautical miles and about 450 ports around the world. It was an awesome experience.
Well, I definitely want to hear the part in which this monkey gets involved.
Okay. Mm. Well, I got to hit a couple of other little ones in the middle. Unless you want me to jump to monkey.
It's up to you.
Okay, let's keep it in sequence because we love the Marquesas, the Tuamotus, and the Society Islands, and the Cook Islands. And we had been out long enough at that point where we were concerned about the weather. This book I mentioned, James Cornell's World Cruising Routes, he has in there the charts that you need, when is the right time to do it, when you shouldn't make a passage. And we followed that religiously. And what it is the compilation of things all the way back dating into Captain Cook and pilot charts that he distills into advice on when to do these things. You can't read the book, but if you want to go from the Marquesas to Tonga, you look in there and he gives you the best times to do it. So anyway, we get to Tonga, the North Island group, and we decided that's where we were going to hunker down for 6 months and wait out the hurricane season or the cyclone season in that territory. And of course, this was an island group with about, I think it was like 4,500 people. I mean, this is small. And we put down a mooring, a big mooring in a very safe place. And we became Tongan residents for this period of time. The first thing I did is went into town to meet some people. And there's a video store. So I go into the video store and he's got lots of videos and we're all hungry for videos. We've been out for quite a while. And I make a deal with him because we had a couple of hundred videos on the boat. So I brought in my library and made a deal with him for 6 months that we could use his library. So he got to rent our films and we became fast friends with him. His brother-in-law owned a grocery store. So now we're friends with, you know, a couple of the key people in town. And I'm telling you, there were some incredible experiences spending, ended up 7 months in Tonga and really becoming locals. From there, we continued on across Tonga, Fiji, Noumea, and then Australia. And then we spent another hurricane season or cyclone season in Australia, in Brisbane, and then worked our way up the Great Barrier Reef, across Indonesia, Singapore, Malaysia, Thailand, then across the Indian Ocean. And we're getting close to the monkey, Talha.
I mean, this is really sounding like a fairy tale. You know, wow.
And yeah. I'm going to tell you, maybe you can hear it in my voice, but it's just fun to share it because I'm reliving it as I'm explaining. Yep. We went to the Maldives, and from the Maldives, we cut up into the Red Sea. And the first place in the Red Sea on the west side is called Djibouti. And this is a French territory, a very small place. And I went into a souk, you know, a little bazaar store there. And we were looking at some things, and I'm not real proud of it, but I wanted to buy a couple of elephant tusks. And this guy's got a monkey. Mm. And the monkey is on a little belt around its waist, tied to a chair. And it's just a teeny little monkey, cutest thing you ever saw. So I asked the guy, how much is a monkey? Mm. And he says, it's not for sale. It's my pet. And I said, come on. I left there with the monkey for $50.
Look at that.
It was nice. The beginning of our own circus on the boat because we had and a dog and a monkey.
Oh, boy.
Because I love animals and so did Samantha.
And could you train the monkey, though? Because the cat and dog, you can still train. I mean, I used to have a pet monkey, so I couldn't train mine at all.
What kind of a monkey did you have, Tala?
It was, I don't know, a Southeast Asian monkey. It wasn't one of the famous ones.
This is
I actually remember the name.
Yeah, a vervet monkey is what I had.
Okay.
It was cute, funny, loved the boat, got along great with the other animals. Too many monkey stories.
Yeah, I have so many monkey stories. So give me some fun ones. Would you like be like your seer? Would you like climb up all the way to the top of the mast and just be like, "Ahoy!" Like, what do you do?
He would run up the mast and scare me to death because he jumped from the spreaders to grab the sheet when we were sailing.
Whoa.
And then he'd walk down the sheet back on the boat and go do it again. Well, man, if he missed,
he's
going to find this little
boat.
He never lost it. It was really fun to watch him play. Some of the hazards of him is the minute we let him out of his cage, he'd go around and he had some favorite things. He liked to take the plug out of the dinghy that was on the foredeck and chew on it. Always getting into some mischief. It was really a hoot having that monkey.
And how about the birds? Did the seagulls like him or hate him? What was the deal there?
I don't think there was ever any interaction between the monkey and...
No? Okay. No. Yeah, because the reason I mentioned it, like, what my monkey used to love to do is he would climb up the tallest tree and then pull on the tails of, like, 100 crows, and there would be this giant swarm of crows above the tree, and then he'd run away, and, yeah, the crows would, like, follow us home. And
that's funny.
Yeah.
Another interesting thing that happened is because of the monkey, we were sitting at the, it's called the Djibouti Yacht Club, which is a gross overstatement. And we met the U.S. ambassador to Djibouti, who loves boats. So he was asking us about the trip and about the monkey, because the monkey's sitting in a chair next to us in the yacht club. The next day, it was his wife's birthday. So they invited us to the embassy for dinner. And he wanted to hear about our trip and show me some stuff that he had. He was trying to design a boat. And we had a wonderful meeting with him. And he says, "Where are you going from here?" And I said, "I've been trying to get a visa to go to Saudi Arabia because I wanted, I didn't want to go along the Somalian coast. I wanted to go on the
east. Canal.
Yeah. But the Saudis would never say no, never say yes. So I kind of gave up. The ambassador said, "Roger, if you manage to get to Jeddah, which is the port we were shooting for, talk to this guy, Chuck Angulo. He's the U.S. consulate in Saudi Arabia. Maybe he can help you." So now we've got the name of the ambassador and U.S. consul general in Saudi Arabia. So we pull up. We're approaching the Jeddah Islamic port. Naturally, by coincidence, it was during Hajj. So their security is at high level. And it was just at the end of Desert Storm. So Americans were most welcome. But there were no yachts. Can't get a visa. So we pull in and ask for a spot to anchor. We finally get a little anchorage spot outside of the port, and out comes a little pilot boat with customs, immigration, and all the officials. And what are we doing there? Of course, we always have the right of safe harbor. Well, we've burned more fuel than we thought, and we need water. Would it be possible for us to do it? And we're sitting on the boat in the middle of the Red Sea at anchor, and the boat is rolling. I mean, the Choili was phenomenal if the sails were up, but it was so beamy with a round bottom and not a deep keel that it was a ball. I get seasick thinking about it. So they said, "Oh my God, this is terrible. You need to come into the port and we'll take care of you with some fuel and water." So
nice.
The next morning we follow them in. Here's this brand new quay that they've built with a, I don't know, $50 million control tower that looks radar out over the whole Red Sea. We're sitting there and we're not there 15 minutes and we see a little forklift come up and deposit a guard shack about 75 feet from the boat. And here's a guy, you know, with an automatic weapon at the guard shack watching us. I didn't feel intimidated, but that was the first thing. And about 5 minutes later, up pulls this big Oldsmobile and two guys in the thobe and gutra. I call it the OPEC garb, you know, the white thobe and the gutra on the hat with the black rope around it. And we find out this is the secret police watching the military watch us.
Oh, boy.
Of course, I'm pretty social, so I go over and meet these guys. And they said, "Okay, we're going to help you arrange to get fuel and water." And I said, "Boy, is there any chance that we might be able to get a visa? We'd love to see Jeddah." "Nope, not possible." So that afternoon, somebody comes down and knocks on the boat. They ask me, "Hey, there's a Commander Jamie Byers, U.S. Military Sealift Command is here. And he saw your American flag and said, what the heck are you doing in the Jeddah Islamic port? I mean, this is not a yacht club. We're the only boat and everything else was commercial." So they said he'd like to come down and visit you. Would you be willing to have him come visit? And I said, man, we'd love it. So he comes down to the boat and he asked us about our story and what we're doing and why we're there. And he said, you know, we've got a host phone. I said, what's a host phone? The Saudis have given us a phone so that we can call home and talk to our families. If you can get permission to come up to my office, you guys can use the phone and call your friends or your family, whatever you want. Well, heck, we've been out for a couple of years now on the ham radio.
Wow.
This was a great opportunity. So we go and we have some fun calling all our friends, and we become friends with Jamie Byers. And he says, you know, we're sending all of these containers home. Do you need any Cokes or water or anything? So he brings them and fills our boat up with beverage, you know, all these beverages, no alcohol, of course. And now he's on the boat. We get a visit from the colonel of the port police, you know, welcoming me and saying, sorry, they can't get a visa. He brings my wife flowers, and they're all being really, really nice to us. We'd been there now maybe 2 or 3 days. They filled up our fuel tanks with the most beautiful diesel fuel I've seen, you know, no dye, look like champagne. I'm happy as a lark. They wouldn't take any money for it. So all these things are happening, and now it's time to leave. So I invited all these people to come to the boat, and I'd made contact with the U.S. Consul General, and I invited him to the boat. And he says, man, we can't come to the boat. You know, we're not permitted in the Jeddah Islamic port. So I said, how come? I don't know. So I go to the colonel of the port police and I said, how come he can't come in? He said, because he drives a diplomatic vehicle and it's not subject to inspection. We can't let an uninspected vehicle in. So I said, well, what if he came in a regular car? Oh, not a problem. And I said, hey, you can come if you bring a regular car and you're not in an official car. So bingo, I've got the consul general, colonel of the port police, commander of the U.S. Navy, and we have this party on the boat making Saudi champagne, which I forget how to make it, but it doesn't have alcohol in it. We had this wonderful time. Everybody's meeting everybody, and it was really a hoot. Of course, they all love the monkey. And we're asking, is there any way we can get a visa? We'd love to see Jeddah. One guy winks at me and says, you know, your wife's eye doesn't look great. Maybe we need an emergency visa to get her to the optometrist there.
And
problem with her eye. So the next day, this is where it gets fun. The next day, these two secret police guys come on board. And as they're walking around the back of the boat where the monkey was tied up with a little belt around the table on the back deck where she liked to play, the monkey reaches over, picks up the thobe, and starts pulling the hair on this guy's legs. He's dancing on the back deck because there's a monkey attacking the hair on his leg. And I figured, boy, that just shot all our chances. But they fell in love with the monkey. So they come into the boat and they started asking us questions. What are we doing there? Where have we been? They said, well, we've got some good news for you. When will you be ready? Ready for what? He said, well, Prince Naif, Minister of the Interior, has invited you to be his guest. You're going to be staying at the Hyatt Regency Hotel. He has a suite for you there, and you'll be our guest. And of course, I was embarrassed. I said, oh, man, we can't accept. That's absolutely incredible, but that's above and beyond. My wife said, shut up, Roger. We'll be ready in an hour. So they send a car. They pick us up. They put guards on the boat so that they could take care of the animals. And off we went, and we spent 2 weeks as guests of the Saudi government going up Taif where the Kuwaitis ruled. And what an amazing place Saudi Arabia was. It's another planet. It's not a city, it's not a country, it's another planet.
We've heard a lot of sailing stories, but I don't think I've ever heard a sailing story twist into such a diplomatic situation.
Mission, yeah.
But you know, the secret police guy, Colonel Fahad, who was our guide now, he was assigned to us. He kept asking me, he says, Roger, tell me, who are you really? And I said, we're nobody. We just happened to meet a few people. He says, I guess you can't tell me. And I said, I'm not lying to you. We're nobody. And it was just a hoot. Too many stories for there. I take the whole time going over that. But we left there. And when we left, we'd made so many friends. They sent the fireboat shooting water out of the hoses on our departure. It was bloody amazing. Went up to Egypt. And then to Tel Aviv, Israel, where we spent 7 months in Tel Aviv, a winter. The first thing that happened as we were approaching the coast of Israel is about 30 miles out, a police boat comes out and they circle us and tell us on the radio, everybody please on deck and let us see your hands. So they want to find out what we're doing there. And we tell them what we're doing, no problem. So they lead us into the Tel Aviv port. And the only place our boat would fit was at the police dock. So here we are at the police dock in Tel Aviv, and we're filling out all the paper. You know, you've got health, immigration, customs, bomb squad. I mean, they really give you the once over. I'm filling all the forms out, and I can say it now, but I had very cleverly hidden some weapons on the boat so that we could defend ourselves if we ever needed it. But they were so well hidden that I never declared them, which is not a good thing. But if you declare something in one part of a country like Mexico, they take the guns, but you have to go back to that same point to get them. So it makes no sense. It doesn't work. So you cheat and you lie and say, no. So I'm filling.
Well, it's your life on the line right now. So yeah, you know, you got to do what you learn. Yeah.
So I'm filling out all this paperwork that says we don't have any guns. We don't have any ammunition. We do have a monkey and a cat and a dog and all these other things. And one of the guys, the official, said to my wife, can I go inside and we need to inspect the boat? Of course. So they go down to the master stateroom.
Find your bazooka.
Well, they didn't find a weapon, but I had a plastic case full of shotgun ammo, maybe 100 pounds or something of shotgun ammo. So Samantha's down there and she doesn't have her glasses with her. So the guy says, can I look in the closet? Of course. He takes out the thing. He opens it up and here's this shotgun ammo. Oh, you can imagine.
Why do you need ammo?
Yeah. So Samantha says, Raj. So I go down there and I'm looking at him, looking at the ammo. And he says, why did you declare this? And I said, because I lied. And he said, this is serious. They all got off the boat and they went to at a 40-foot ocean container right there on the dock, which was their office. So they go to the office and they said, do not get off the boat. And where's the weapon? And I'm trying to think, where is there a 12 gauge where there isn't an Uzi with a silencer and all this other stuff? I come up with a 12 gauge and a pistol and I give it to him. And the penalty is confiscation of the boat, imprisonment of me. And Sam, I mean, this is really serious stuff. So they said, don't get off the boat. And I waited about 15 minutes, which seemed like an eternity. And I went up, got off the boat, went to their office, pushed the door open, fell to my knees and said, I can't stand it. What are you going to do to me? And they all cracked up. And they said, bring the guns up here. We don't have room for the ammo. Keep the ammo on the boat. And you shouldn't have done that. And you can stay here at the police dock because there's no other place for you. So we spent like 6 or 7 months at the police dock.
What?
And there were more monkeys. Monkeys started there and on and on. So many more stories.
but so, like, how far down the liveaboard venture are we now? We're still in the first single digits. No way.
Yeah, probably 3 years. I've got a website and I can't remember.
We'll put it at the end anyway, but mention it now so people know where to start looking.
Yeah, okay. It's called Offline Online. Offline is the name of our new boat, or the boat that I have. We live aboard now, or I live aboard. And it's offlineonline.com. Now it's sort of outdated, but if you look on the left side, it's got the voyage track and all the details of, you know, the 450 ports we went to. And my dog says, have a drink. This is Barnacle.
Barnacle.
That's adorable. So maybe, Roger, before we close off part one, because we definitely want to come back for part two, tell us, like, maybe just a couple of tips for, like, somebody who wants to do something crazy like this. Just, did it happen for you? It could just happen out of the blue, right? 6 months could turn into 30 years. Yeah. So, but how does somebody even start fairy tale like that?
Well, I think you have to be a bit adventuresome and have your mate on the same page. I mean, you both have to be willing to try it. And I told you about, I think the best tip I have is get something that's comfortable, that, you know, the positive of being comfortable is more maintenance, you know, more upkeep, needing to have a generator to keep all of those nice things functioning. So there's more work, but if you don't do it, it's like going camping. And who wants to go camping for 13 years?
Mm.
So I think if you have the desire to be adventuresome, then make it comfortable for your wife. And I think you'll enjoy the comfort as well. So that would be James Skoog, Cruising in Comfort. He talks about awnings and sunshades and things that make life aboard pleasant. Otherwise, it can really be tough.
Awesome, Roger. Well, everyone, tune in for part two, where we actually talk about how he started Nautical Ventures and building an empire in Florida.
Yeah, Roger. Great having you on the show, man. Thanks so much.
Check back every Tuesday for our latest episode. And be sure to like, share, and subscribe to ShipShape.pro.